Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Welcome, welcome. It's time to join us at Espigan Journal Club for another thrilling jaunt of discovery and conquest in the wild and wonderful lands of pediatric gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition, led by the dauntless Dr. Jake Mann and his faithful companion, Spike the Wonder Dog. Say hello, Spike. Me, I'm just along for the ride. Hey, Jake, a tip of your hat to the audience, please. And like Spike, say hello.
Hi, morning, everyone.
Jake's choices for today. First, from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by Tai et al., with authors from institutions in Taiwan, Thailand, and Korea, a prediction model for genetic cholestatic disease in infancy using the machine learning approach. Second, from JCI, I suppose that's Journal of Clinical Investigation, Insight, by Aronson et al., who write from institutions in the United States and the United Kingdom. Efficacious genome editing in infant mice with glycogen storage disease type 1A. So today it's machine learning and it's gene therapy, and we are WIN Journal Club, as always, out in front where Jake keeps dragging us. Jake, the contribution from Tai et al. Postulates that genetic analysis in neonatal cholestasis without mechanical obstruction is expensive and at many sites difficult of access. It advocates screening for genetic analysis and reports the retrospective sifting of 47 sets of results per patient with intrahepatic neonatal cholestasis, 1,008 patients in all, that were seen at a single institution. 63 of these patients had eventually been diagnosed with, quote, genetic cholestasis, close quote. Among the 47 parameters initially assessed at presentation and 1 month thereafter, 20 of the findings, not including sonographic findings, proved in combination to track genetic cholestasis. And mind you, this was after mechanical cholestasis had been excluded. We're not told anything about the involvement in this study of biopsy results, liver biopsy results, to do anything more than possibly to exclude mechanical cholestasis. The predictive utility of this combination then was checked in 36 patients with genetic cholestasis and 62 without from two other institutions, one in Thailand and one in Korea. Overall, approximately 70% of patients evaluated were identified as unlikely to have genetic cholestasis, and the authors argue might have been spared genetic analysis. Mind you, it's not that the patients are spared genetic analysis, it's that somebody's pocket is being spared genetic analysis. The authors then propose use of the algorithm as devised by machine learning as a cost-saving measure. Well, Jack, what do you think of all this?
I think that genetic testing is becoming more common as a routine part of clinical care across almost all specialties, and there needs to be, like every test, some method of which when you decide when to use it and when you decide when not to use it. I guess I really wanted to talk about this paper, partly because of the actual detail from a neonatal jaundice perspective, but also part of the kind of methods involved in designing a study like this and how it can perhaps influence the results based on the numbers involved and the machine learning methods.
You'll have to take it away from here, because that sort of analysis is definitely above my pay grade.
So I guess from the first perspective, from the kind of clinical perspective, there's the question to me. I was a little bit worried that the study didn't make sense to answer the question they wanted to address, because I'd say that one of the key questions is, when you have a baby who is jaundiced, is this biliary atresia? Do they need an on-table cholangiogram? Or is this, for example, Alagille syndrome, and we don't need to go to an on-table cholangiogram, we need to gather enough evidence to wait the genetics at a later date and proceed otherwise with medical management? And firstly, this, what they've proposed, does not aim to address that question.
Exactly, because it says all of these kids have already passed that watershed.
Yes.
You've already ruled out biliary atresia or other conditions that are lead to mechanical cholestasis. And in that respect, it seems to me that they have set up a straw man and have fought the straw man very effectively, but it's not a real-life situation.
Yeah, so exactly. They have not attempted to deal with what is probably the most difficult question. But that doesn't mean that this isn't an important question to deal with. Say, for example, a baby who then the team, or for whatever reason you've decided, doesn't have biliary atresia, or perhaps let's say they went for an on-table cholangiogram and then were found to have an intact extrahepatic biliary system. And then you're seeing them in clinic 2 weeks later, and then you're deciding, should we send the genetic analysis? This would be the time to implement their system.
Fair enough. Now, let's just cross the channel from where you are. We're now in France. And in France, they don't believe in liver biopsy, do they? Not in this situation. They say, ha, as long as we can find the triangular cord sign and a shriveled gallbladder, who needs cholangiography? We'll just take the kid to surgery.
Well, it also, I think, varies as to whether or not you're north of south of Watford to determine in the UK whether or not some of these kids have a liver biopsy prior to going to for a on-table cholangiogram.
I'm always interested in the details of heresy. Tell me about this.
Having as someone who's only ever trained in one institution in Birmingham, our current practice for that assessment of these children is that we try to make a clinical judgment based on ultrasonographic findings, examination of the stool, and when necessary, a Tobida or a Hyda scan, and then not going for a liver biopsy prior to on-table cholangiogram, plus minus proceed to Kasai portoenterostomy.
Well, I'm very, as a histopathologist, you know that I'm very, very sorry to hear that. At any rate, that takes us away from the thrust of what you wanted to discuss,
yes,
which is machine learning. I apologize.
Yes. No, but I think it's really important when you're interpreting this paper to understand exactly which clinical context it operates in. And it's that, I know they've illustrated in that diagram as number two, but it's totally critical to understanding the limitation of, it's not necessarily a limitation, it's what the data is used to illustrate. I think then that the second consideration is the numbers involved. So 1,000 is clearly a large number and a totally appropriate number to implement one of these models. However, I just get sometimes a bit anxious when we have such a skewed proportion of roughly 50 cases and 950 non-cases. The chances that then you can, I'm not entirely sure of why, but all I remember speaking to the statisticians who really understand this kind of stuff is that when you have very skewed proportions like that, funny things can happen in the models. There is clearly a more technical explanation, but
we're just going to leave aside wizardry at the moment.
If that's okay, it's just a kind of, if you're designing one of these studies, just be wary that if you have a very large, either case or control kind of disproportion ratio, and then try to do a prediction model from it, you can get false positives and false negatives.
Do you suspect that that has taken place here?
I don't have any specific evidence to do so, but it just kind of pricked my interest in reading it. I think most of the things that they've proposed and demonstrated, so for example, in their genetic cholestasis, they tend to have higher transaminases and perhaps a lower gamma GT and a higher direct bilirubins. That all makes sense, for example, if they had some of the forms of PFIC. I guess the other thing that does make sense when you read it in detail, though again may not initially appeared to be the case is that these authors have included in their final model only the bloods at baseline and then at 1 month follow-up, though in their graphs they've illustrated the bloods all the way up to a year. So it does make sense to only include bloods at time zero and 1 month if, for example, you're going on that clinical setting of, we've seen a baby, we've decided they don't have biliary atresia, now I'm reviewing them in clinic a month later, should I send their genetic analysis? And that's when to use it.
All right. It struck me in reading the paper that this had was also front-loaded to in a somewhat unfair way by they're saying that we didn't include sonographic findings in assessing these patients. That is, they had already come through whatever screening was necessary for extrahepatic biliary atresia, and then sonography was off the cards. And I really would have been more pleased with the paper if they had said, and these are the kinds of genetic cholestasis that we detected. I didn't find any correlation, any listing of what they found. And speaking as someone who has practiced exclusively in the Western world, I wonder how much cystic fibrosis was identified, and I'm almost certain that alpha-1 antitrypsin storage disorder never got any play at all.
Yes, whereas it would have been a...
citrin deficiency now, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So this probably also does come with the context, the caveat of how generalizable is this to all centers around the world? And the data was derived and then validated in two centers in Taiwan and Thailand, and is probably
Korea, Thailand and Korea for the validation,
And it's going to be more valid for that genetic ancestry.
Well, our producer is telling us that it's time to move on to the next article, if that's all right with you. And if that's okay, then we can just switch back to the Western world, where alpha-1 antitrypsin storage disorder is part and parcel of our daily lives. But it's not about that that you wanted us to speak. It's about the fact that clinical caregivers and biomedical researchers at Duke University in North Carolina have made rather a hobby of glycogen storage disorders, their causes and cures, including glycogen storage disease type 1A, which is deficiency of glucose 6-phosphate. Glucose 6-phosphate transferase. Adeno-associated virus has been used as a vector in mice, dogs, and humans to convey into hepatocytes and renal tubular epithelium functional G6PC copies called transgenes. These encode the catalytic subunit of G6PC, in which variants cause GSD1A. Unfortunately, G6PG transgenes thus introduced into hepatocytes are episomal, and episomal G6PC is rapidly lost in model mice and dogs, particularly in infant mice, a loss for which repeated or increased transfection... my mobile is flashing. I have to take this call. Mr. President, don't go on red alert. Yes, transfection. The word has trans in it, but so does transportation. Nothing woke here. Thank you. That man. Jake, where was I? Yes. For which such transfection does not compensate adequately, the Duke Blue Devils have used, as the article for discussion reports, CRISPR and CAS9-based techniques in 12-day-old G6PC null mice to achieve long-term genomic integration of G6PC with euglycemia that extends at least to age 12 weeks, which must be long-term in a mouse. Will this prevent development in treated mice of hepatocellular adenomata and carcinomata that develop in untreated humans and in episomally treated but euglycemic mice and dogs? More studies are required. More funding is required. Jake, is this of interest at the moment other than as a glance into the prospects for gene therapy in liver disease?
I'm sure to this specific group and obviously to this specific study, yes, but I would have said it's generally interesting for that exact reason, that gene therapy is a rapidly progressing field across a wide range of specialties, and there are now several gene therapies using AAV vectors licensed and in use, albeit generally in small numbers, and looking to ways that that can be improved and developed is great work. So I think that it's really interesting to see here the combination of CRISPR-Cas9 with AAV transgenes and demonstrating that that can improve the function, at least in a in vivo model.
Why do you think they stopped at 12 weeks?
I think that there's been a lot of work to go into this study, and 12 weeks is a clearly adult mouse, and it would suggest that you've got probably to the point where your hepatocytes have stopped proliferating. So hopefully by that point, if you have stable function, you'll have a higher degree of confidence that you would have ongoing stable expression of the gene, let's say to 6 months. Every time it is having, until I'd done one of these types of experiments, not a gene experiment, but a murine experiment, you often think, oh yeah, it would be great. We should just extend it by 3 months. We'd get all that long-term data. But with the multiple cohorts involved, it takes so long, and then the time and cost investment for an extra 3 months, for example, is enormous.
So cut your losses and publish.
Well, I think if you're confident that you've demonstrated efficacy, let's say in an adult mouse, then that seems pretty good. And I've no doubt perhaps they've already got the follow-up study running and they're seeing how the mice do at 12 months. But if they're confident they've got a story here, and they obviously do, then yeah, publish and then keep going.
And what other disorders do you think this approach is applicable?
Well, I think that it's applicable to almost any genetic liver disease where a defective gene is the culprit. So many of the GSDs, but also you can imagine that it could be also applicable to clotting factor deficiencies. It could be applicable to some of the genetic cholestasis disorders that we've already described. The challenge really for humans is that, unlike in mice, the AAV can generate a significant immune response in itself. So there is only the option of a single dose of AAV containing the transgene. So in humans, you have to be confident that you're going to get good enough integration, good enough viral infection of hepatocytes so that they can then be propagated. And that means giving it in general at a time when there's no more hepatocyte proliferation. Whereas in this context, they're giving it to mouse pups with a neonatal liver.
So this approach might be beautiful for the second child born in a kindred.
Yes. For example, if you were able to, if this worked, let's say, complete speculation, if this worked in humans, you know someone has very high risk of GSD1, for example, so they undergo genetic testing within the first few days of life, and then you have the result, let's say, by 1 month, a targeted panel, and then you're able to more or less cure their GSD at 1 month old, rather than having to wait until they are at least childhood, early adulthood, before you'd be able to give an AAV into a stable, expanded liver.
What do you think we're going to see in these mice or these dogs or humans as they progress and age? If GSD1A is cured in the liver, what about at extrahepatic sites?
Well, they may well have their extrahepatic manifestations, because in general, the AAV is taken up by the liver. I don't think that they did anything funky to the AAV to specifically target the hepatocytes here, but I would need to double check. But in general, if you give the AAV, it goes to the liver rather than going to, let's say, the bone marrow, for example, where So these kids would have, or presumably the dogs, would have the extrahepatic manifestations still. So this gene type of gene therapy, I guess, kind of also like liver transplant for metabolic conditions.
Yes.
You have to be aware that it is an excellent treatment for the liver-derived problems, but cannot cure necessarily every manifestation of the condition.
As with so much that we do, we never cure. We swap one set of problems for another that is in some ways easier to live with.
Hmm.
Well, Doc Sisyphus, with that, we'll just let the boulder roll down the hill again, eh?
Like they say, life is merely choosing to select one set of problems before you move on to select another set of problems.
Let me thank the listeners, then, for having joined us today. Let me thank you for leading the discussion. And let me say, it was wonderful to see Spike in the studio. Bring him back.
Thanks. Speak soon, Alex.